Welcome to Talking in This Climate, a series where we discuss the different aspects of talking about climate change and environmental issues. We're a mix of environment students, graduates, and environmental communication professionals who are really interested in how we talk about climate in this climate. Each episode, we'll dive into a different theme, looking at things like language, the media, communicating through frames and metaphors, Indigenous perspectives on environmental issues, communicating across disciplines, issues of trust and misinformation, emotion, and how we can ultimately strive to become more mindful listeners, communicators, and agents of change. We're so excited for this journey and so grateful that you're here traveling with us. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome all of the listeners back to the podcast. This is episode 5, and we'll be talking about climate change and how it can be framed as the apocalypse or within an apocalyptic framing, and sort of some of the consequences or impacts of that. So I think some of the things that might be revealed in our discussions and some things that we've probably all experienced firsthand is how climate change can be a really scary thing to think about and feel and engage with, and how apocalyptic framings of climate change or kind of catastrophic narratives about climate change impacts, how that can have an effect on our agency and the way we engage with the issues of climate change. And in this episode, we will be referring to an article by Eric Swingadow from 2010 called Apocalypse Forever, Post-Political Populism and the Specter of Climate Change. So I think just to kick off the conversation, I wanted to ask each of you, does the future of the world due to climate change really feel apocalyptic to you at the moment? And if so, or if not, why? I think that might be a good starting point to just get a sense of how we're feeling about the trajectory of climate change. And does it align with a description of the apocalypse or catastrophe? And if so, what aspects of that come to mind?
In my mind, apocalyptic means that I'll be facing the worst impacts of climate change, like heat, stress, droughts, and other stuff. But it does feel apocalyptic in a sense whenever I read through stuff and whenever I see the latest news. But in the back of my mind, I always have this picture where I still believe that we might be able to mitigate the worst impacts of climate change and find solutions to adapt by the time. So it's mainly hopeful, although I feel the apocalypse is on its way, but I still remain hopeful in the back of my mind.
Mm-hmm. So I think just because we might fear like a change or a negative like future doesn't mean that we can't still be hopeful of either averting those sort of crises or still finding joy or like happiness or fulfillment or some sort of like prosperity within that kind of world. But when you think of apocalypse, and you sort of said that you do kind of see the future as a bit apocalyptic, what does that sort of mean in a material sense to you? So you mentioned like heat and heat stress and droughts and stuff.
I mentioned heat and drought because these were the two things that I felt over the course of my childhood. Mm. And it was always getting warmer at the place where I live, and we only got to buy air conditioning systems like a few years ago, and until then we used to paint our top of the house white to make the house cool. And the other one is droughts, where we would experience a shortage of food supplies in our region due to drought in the southeast part of India. And these are the main two things that come to my mind because I feel like these are the only two things that I felt the most.
Mm.
Yeah.
Thanks, Fani. Emily, what does the future feel apocalyptic to you because of climate change? And if so, why?
I think I do worry, even though I have no specific idea on how it's going to look like. Even though, you know, we all sort of have a sense of what's coming our way, it's still sometimes a bit hard to grasp that stark reality of what's going to happen. And so it's kind of like a mix between still feeling hopeful and hoping that things may not turn out as bad as, you know, science predicts, and kind of accepting the stark reality that we are going to live in a world that is very different to now and to the past. So I guess I often don't really also want to focus on that, but being able to stay hopeful, I suppose, that makes sense. If I think too much about the reality of the impact of climate change and how this will affect everyone, but especially the people that I love and the things that I care about. Yeah, I think it's a hard balance to keep.
Mm. And how do you sort of manage that, trying to still be aware and, like, you know, aware of the issues and the potential risks and things, but also managing how it feels and so that it's not overwhelming and so that doesn't sort of exhaust you? How do you sort of manage that?
I guess I try to focus on the things that I can control, the things that I can do now, and the things that I can do in the future that I think have the biggest impact, or, you know, doesn't necessarily have to have a big impact, but that make me feel good if I do them, if that makes sense. Because I know that they will have some sort of impact or will make a change, I guess. Yeah, just doing the things that I can do that aren't in my power to do, and satisfying also that feeling that I don't want to be the person that looks back on their past and thinks, oh shoot, I should have done more, if that makes sense.
Mm.
While also keeping a balance of, like, not doing too much. just to keep the balance right between being active but also not restricting myself to the only necessary things in life.
Mm. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of us can probably relate to similar feelings, trying to maintain a sustainable approach to the things that we try to do. Rosie, does the future of climate change and the world feel apocalyptic to you at the moment?
I feel like answering that question, it depends what day of the week you catch me.
Today is Monday, so how do you feel on Mondays?
Some days I do feel like it's apocalyptic, like you read, especially like what you were saying, finding like the scientific side of things, and like what you said before about food shortages, like, really freaks me out, because it's also like that really like strong feeling of injustice, of knowing there are food shortages, but it doesn't mean anyone actually needs to starve. And we've always actually had that problem. That's an issue about, like, distribution rather than climate. So during those periods when it's like, when I'm feeling low and apocalyptic, I think it's because I get caught in all the webs of everything that's connected to an issue. It's not just about climate. It's about our systems and the way that we do things and the way that we... And recognizing all of that actually has to change together, not just how we react or how we feel about climate. And then on my good days, I think I'm more like you, Emily, where I'm just like, okay, the world's really big, and being globalized hasn't meant we can, you know, be part of everything. We just got to pick something and, you know, really focus that energy. And I think when I can really emotionally and intellectually feel that's probably when I don't feel apocalyptic. I just kind of feel like you just live a life and you do what you do, and then that's the life.
Mm.
Yeah, picking your battle, I guess, just choosing what you can focus on.
Mm. Yeah,
and I think when it comes to climate change, the more you know and the more you know about the science, then the more anxious you feel. So there's a blissful ignorance in some people not knowing as much about it. And it's a, it feels like a bit of a burden, really. But you also do feel like you have a responsibility the more you learn about it to try and at least try and do something, even if it feels like you're fighting an uphill battle. But, yeah, I think it feels worse to completely give in to that feeling of despair for me.
Mm.
I'd always rather try and, like Fani said, try and have to balance it out by having a little bit of hope while also being realistic and thinking this is likely to be quite horrible even in our own lifetimes, but we're still going to try.
Mm. So does the future for you, Ewan, feel apocalyptic? Would you use that word to describe it?
Yeah, I would.
Mm. And in what sort of ways? Is there any specific, I guess, imagination, like in your imagination, can you see anything in particular that resonates with you, like how this might play out?
Well, I imagine things being pretty terrible for humans, and the planet eventually will heal itself. So I guess it's apocalyptic in the sense that it is for us, but it may not be for the world. And I almost find a bit of comfort in that, even though it's horrible. But, the feeling that we are only here for a tiny, tiny moment of the Earth's history, and there's so many billions of years that'll happen after we're gone, but it's still, you know, we can still do something that will hopefully mitigate some of the worst aspects of that for humankind. But, yeah, in a strange way, like the idea of a life after humans is comforting to me.
Mm. Mm. Why do you think that is?
I'm not sure. I think it's just, maybe it's actually a giving in, like a sort of get out of jail free card in a way that it's like, well, I mean, I will try, but even if I don't try, we'll all get wiped out and the world will be fine eventually anyway. So it's possibly not a good thing, but I don't know. When I have those dark thoughts about, I think the most despairing I feel is with the politics of it and the way it's used as this kind of, you know, people who know that the science is true will still put forward absurd positions on things like fossil fuel use and take advantage of people's ignorance and push those agendas for their own gains. And that makes me feel really despairing. And then I have these dark thoughts about, oh, well, the world will heal itself and we'll all be gone. But I'm not sure if it's a good thing, but it's just a feeling I get sometimes. But I try not to go down that path at all. But
It's a really interesting perspective, Ewan, and it's also reflective of, like, the religious roots of apocalypse thinking.
Mm.
Because it's like, well, the apocalypse happens and then those who are saved remain on Earth and it heals itself and can live out, I don't know, heaven?
Definitely. I hadn't actually thought about the religious aspects of it until now, stupidly. But that totally makes sense because with apocalyptic religions, like I'm thinking about Jehovah's and where the apocalypse is really central to that type of religion, then what happens on Earth barely matters. Like it's all about the aftermath.
Mm. And Zoe, how does the future sort of feel for you? Does apocalypse or does that word resonate with how you feel about what's coming?
You are on the money, Tim. It does not.
Mm. How come?
I've just never resonated with that word.
Mm.
I see it in, like, films and books. Like, I loved reading Good Omens, which is literally about the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Mm.
But I just, a lot of the depictions of the apocalypse is, you know, like there's fire and blood and like the devil and I don't know, there's so much of that. And I don't see the climate crisis as that. I don't see it as so overt. It's got a subtlety to it. That the apocalypse just, like the apocalypse, it isn't subtle. And perhaps it's the way that we're living through the climate crisis currently that I feel disassociated from the apocalypse. I mean, that's quite a nice way to feel, to not to not feel like I'm living in the apocalypse. But yeah, like funny, I grew up with significant drought. We had below 10% of the water for the state as a kid. Like that's how I grew up. Like dam levels, like water storage was below 10%. And it was really scary, but I don't know. I don't feel apocalyptic yet.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little more about what you mean by the how it's like it's more subtle? Do you mean like it's in terms of how it plays out, it sort of happens over a longer period of time and maybe it's not defined as, yeah, like one big event? Is that kind of what you mean?
Yeah, it's lots of small flow-on effects that aren't culminating. It's not culminating in one big event mm-hmm. of the four horsemen coming. Like it's slow and it's more... Like we can see there's rapid biodiversity loss now, but then when you look at, you know, like the rate that the sea levels are rising isn't, you know, at that same speed, and perhaps everything will like tick to this weird level where humans will all of a sudden immediately all stop being able to survive. But I don't know, maybe it's thinking of it with a more than human lens as well. I'm like, the apocalypse is so human-centric, but the climate crisis isn't. And so they don't fit together in my head.
Mm.
But yeah, I do think that the apocalypse is a really human-centric term.
Mm.
And the climate crisis is just so much more than human. Mm. And I have a lot of... like anger and upset and overwhelm. Overwhelm is a word that I would use mm-hmm. rather than apocalyptic. Overwhelm, like despair, anger. I wouldn't say apocalyptic. And just like you wouldn't say, oh, I feel heavenly about the climate crisis. You'd say, I feel hopeful. I just feel like this religious language doesn't serve for at least my perspective in communicating about the climate crisis.
Mm.
But it does for many people, and it relates it to so many people's like understanding of society and values and morals. Like, it's quite interesting.
It is. And I think we will explore, we'll flesh more of that out later. But it's interesting that this is the type of word that we, I suppose, have employed or deployed when referring
have we
to.
Though?
Well, it seems to be
an economic metaphor.
maybe not like we, like individually, but I think it's definitely a word that I've seen used a lot alongside the climate emergency movement. I was watching.
That's quite interesting.
Yeah, so I was watching Big Weather, the recent ABC series last night. And apocalyptic for me would be the word to use for the footage that I was watching of the last summer's bushfires. And I haven't got up to the next episode, which is on flooding and stuff. But for me, it sort of did have this sort of almost biblical wrath, kind of out of control. This is next level kind of.
But it's fire. I really wonder if you'd have this, sorry, but would you, I want homework, Tim. Watch next week's episode next week and let me know if the floods felt apocalyptic.
Okay.
Because fire is so deeply associated with the apocalypse. I wonder if the floods
Floods are quite biblical too, aren't they?
They're pretty biblical, but they're not that's not apocalyptic.
I guess it depends really what you understand as apocalyptic yourself. We may just have, you know, different understandings of it or see it differently based on our backgrounds, whether we, you know, a bit more religious than others. We might just be talking about different ideas of is apocalyptic and what is the apocalypse.
Yeah. And then also what you're growing up with. Like all summer, in my summers, coming home from school, the sky turns green or black and you're like, it is going to storm so heavily. If it's green, it's going to hail and you've got to, like, get home. And so, like, those for other people are kind of very strong cues that something is going wrong, but it's just like, no, it's a storm in my mind. But I feel like the sky changing color to green or black in, you know, at 2, 3 p.m. for people who aren't used to that could feel apocalyptic.
That reminds me of the Black Saturday fires, actually. I was going to work at 3 o'clock that day, getting the tram, and the sky just black at that time of day. It's just so odd. And everything shimmering. It just felt so otherworldly and unnatural and scary. Maybe Zoe's right about where you grow up, because you're more used to extreme weather events than we are. But for me, when they do come, it's definitely feels a bit apocalyptic.
I think what you're pointing at really is like being familiar with something or not being familiar with something. And then if we're not familiar, if we don't know why things look different than what they're supposed to be looking like, then maybe we feel something is wrong, if that makes sense. Even though it may not be wrong, as Zoe said, well, for her, you know, green sky indicates storm is coming, whereas other people
would
be looking
storm.
At yeah, hailstorm coming. it's because of the different water vapor. Anyway, that's why Tim is green. And yeah, I think it's just not, you know, everything that is sort of like, as you said, Uranus, like, it's not from this world. We may define as apocalyptic, but it might just not be. It might just be something we're not very familiar with. We don't understand 100%. We can't explain potentially. And therefore we put it in that category, even though it might still be natural.
Perhaps a nice way to frame these things could be, because we automatically want to say, oh, it was out of this world, we could say, oh, that's so out of my worldview. To be more accurate. And then that, because also, like, all of us have such different worldviews, we've come from such different places, schools of thought, tastes and board games. and it's because for some people it is part of their world or their worldview, but for others it's never even entered.
That's true, and I think fire is a good example of that, Zoe, because, you know, Tim, it's apocalyptic when we think of it as bushfires, but then if you talk to a lot of First Nations people, they will say that in Australia anyway, we should have always been learning to live with fire. And from that worldview, then we would feel very differently about seeing those types of scenes. We would probably interpret it differently as well, what it means.
Yeah, that's a good point, Rosie.
Definitely.
So in my mind, floods feel very apocalyptic because as I was growing up, we had a tsunami coming to the southern coast, and we also had heavy rainfall which would destroy thousands of acres of crops. So in my mind, fire has nothing to do with apocalypse, but flooding has everything to do with it. Yeah, I think what you said, Emily, is right. It just depends on the experiences that one had on how they define the apocalypse.
This is a thought experiment I've sort of had for a long time, which is, if the planet was absent of life, but it still had what we would define as tsunamis and hurricanes and crazy storms and things like that, would that be catastrophic? Like, would we look at that and describe that as something catastrophic?
Like if a bear shit in the woods?
Kind of.
If a tree falls and no one hears it, does it fall?
Yeah.
That's how I hear this conundrum.
Yeah,
because it's subjective.
Yeah.
And how do you know?
I suppose what I'm saying is not so much the philosophical question of like how we know or what we know, but more about how we experience and how we describe, like what language do we draw on to describe what we experience and what we imagine about the future. And I think a lot of the natural disasters that have been happening and will happen are things that are just beyond the limit of what we're used to or what we've seen in newspapers or what has been recorded in written or, you know, in our recorded history. So I think events that happen beyond that threshold of what, you know, we thought was possible, I think is one of the reasons why we reach, I say we as in generally like people in the public or people in the media or scientists even reach for these words, because it's not something that has been seen before in many cases and is happening on a sort of a much larger scale than I think has been seen before. And again, going to what Fani was saying is, I think again, it's that heavily grounded in that experience. Yeah.
For sure. I think for me, something clicked when I moved to Indonesia and something I've never had experienced before. And one example was when I just wanted to go for lunch from the office to the mall, which is like a minute walking really. And everyone, like the security guy was like, oh, you should take an umbrella. You can have my umbrella. And I was like, no, it's fine. I'll just run. It'll be fine. And I was drenched. I was soaked. And it's just something I was just not used to. And I was like, I'm so dumb. Like, the locals just told me you shouldn't do that. And I've completely ignored it. And, you know, in Jakarta, where I used to live, flooding is just, it's just a regular occurrence. And it's always like really dramatic. You know, things are under water all the time, and especially in the northern areas of the city, it's really, really bad. But it's just sort of an annual occurrence because of, you know, the rain patterns and the monsoon in general. And so when it rains here and people are like, oh, this is raining a lot, like I don't know. Like, usually I'm like, this is not rain, seriously. It's this thing. And that's what it is.
Yes.
And I think it's just, as you said, or we've just discussed, it's just like lived experience and whether we can relate it to something we know or we can't, like yeah,
we had some the other night. We had hail yesterday and it was all beautiful.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and because I'm right next to the tin roof and you're just hearing the hail boom 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 on the tin roof. I could barely hear scrublands on top of the hail noise. But it's yeah, like it was part of our growing up. You know, you're at kindy and it's like, get the kids inside, the hail's coming. And then we'd go out and after the storm you collect the, you know, the golf ball sized hail. And that's just like thing natural, you know, that's just normal. Things falling from the sky was fun. It was an afternoon activity collecting it. Terrifying, but you know what I mean? There's such a different narrative around it.
I think though, with your example and the example you brought up, Emily, in Jakarta, I feel like they're more examples of like the sublime experiences you can have with nature, where it can make you feel so lucky to be alive and so like on the edge almost, though. But you can feel sublime because you make it, you know, you're not going to necessarily like die or not survive those events. Whereas I think with your question, Tim, it's more like, when there is a world in which humans cannot witness those things because we're either not there, and would we still then call it a catastrophe? I do think that's different. And I think because, I mean, that's how the world was made, right? Like lots and lots of volcanoes, which we definitely wouldn't have survived. And then this huge ice age, which we definitely wouldn't have survived. And then also a period where there was no oxygen, where we, again, definitely couldn't have survived. So I think going back to what you were saying before then, Zoe, about how this world is really human-centric, it's true because the way the world is made wasn't catastrophic. It's just the way the world is made. Mm. But knowing that we're not in it anymore and that we can't be in it anymore because the environmental terrain will change so drastically is maybe an apocalyptic bit, knowing that, being really aware.
Yeah, I guess for me, I feel okay with that. I feel totally okay with humans not being here at some point. But I am quite comfortable with death. I think death is essential. It has to happen. It's natural, and nothing is here forever. And to expect humans to always be on Earth when nothing that we know has ever always been on human Earth. I mean, apart from probably a few very small things, like things come and go, and that's okay. I'm just all right with that.
It's interesting you bring that up, because in the notes that we have to sort of prepare for our discussion, Rosie raised an interesting question about, I guess, humanity's death anxiety and how this is potentially linked to these apocalyptic narratives. And then I think in the notes, we sort of got on to thinking about, is it the end of life that we fear, or is it the end of capitalism and the existing sort of systems that we just can't grapple with, like the existing sort of social order, or fear of anarchy or something?
I think let's asterisk life to be human life. And yes, I agree then. It's the fear of human life ending, I think.
See, I think a lot of maybe my own, holding a mirror up to the way I feel about seeing images of like natural disasters and things like that, and trying to imagine a better future or a possible like step forward from where we are now, does involve a dramatic reshaping of, I suppose, capitalism and other large systems and democracies and things. And I think that's pretty unsettling.
That's the part that makes me feel hopeful.
That's the best part, Tim.
Because you think like we have degrees.
I like the idea of changing our political system and our social structures to be more caring and less focused on accumulating wealth. I think that's a part of the change that I find exciting. But
me too.
It's the best.
I guess it's how you frame it. Like,
So one of the things that the notes and the discussion notes got me thinking about is often, like on TV, like with interviews with politicians and things, and when the issue of climate change comes up and the issue of, say, Australia not properly responding to climate change and reducing emissions and all these sorts of things, I think there's a dramatic, misfocus on what issue we're supposed to be talking about, because often there's these dramatic frustrations and general frustrations, which I think are very valid, about not enough progress being made on climate change, without even mentioning the kind of systems that have been set up that drive the problems of climate change, which perhaps should be more discussed as symptoms of our systems and our relations and our, consumption of resources and things like that, rather than climate change by isolated as an issue or as seen as like natural disasters as separate from what we do. I think that's something which we society globally as well, we're not comfortable talking about that. There is not political space to talk about that, I don't think, yet. And I'm also very excited about, post-capitalism or transforming our systems and things. I think what scares me is the fact that there are so many entrenched powers that prevent us from being able to make that change fast enough.
And then you can have the feelings of despair setting in when you think about that and leading to a more apocalyptic thoughts.
Yeah, exactly.
So I just think that I'm listening to very different spaces than you are, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
I predominantly only hear climate change spoken about within the social context of these systems and structures and powers that exist. I think that natural disasters or the climate disaster, what's the new, because the bushfire commission just came back and it's being, they've found that it was climate change induced. So it's no longer a natural disaster. It's because my mind is blanking. For now, we will call it a climate change disaster. But these bring like those grounding images that people can relate to make an issue that is understood through systems that are kind of invisible. I think it brings a tangibility to it. You know, like the even just the videos of the glaciers falling. But I think there's a tangibility factor of it being understood through disasters. But I don't think that, I think the climate crisis is commonly spoken to or about through the systems and structures that it exists within.
Yeah, sure. I guess one of the examples is, you know, when the last summer's bushfires were going on, the question about the link, relationship, correlation, causation between Australia's climate action and emissions reduction to the bushfires, you know, raged on in the media for a couple of weeks. And there was a lot of mis and disinformation about that as well. So I don't think it really is necessarily as obvious or simple a lot of the time. And the connections are very often difficult to explain as well, because it is really complicated. And I think I don't know the names of the actual positions, but the people who are leading the emergency disaster responses, it actually took them time to find the right language to explain the relationship between Australia's emissions overall and the severity of the bushfires. And I think, I can't remember what the metaphors that came out up like a few weeks later were, but they were more successful at being able to explain to the public. Do you know what I mean? Like it's kind of complicated, and finding the right words and the right way of explaining that relationship, I think, is tricky.
As just a normal being, I suppose it's sometimes really hard to make that connection if you're not constantly exposed to that type of language as well, but also to climate change topics. And so that makes it really hard to have something like greenhouse gas emissions that you can't touch, can't feel, you can't smell, and then, you know, connected to something that's so tangible like a bushfire and the impact that it has. That's just a massive challenge. And especially if it's, you know, something in the air that can travel around the world and has impacts everywhere. So to kind of localize it and say, well, this is, you know, this is our fault in a way. And also accepting, taking on that responsibility, I think it's also a big step.
That's a really interesting point, Anne, just about how responsibility is crystallized after discussions about, I don't know, cause and effect and things like that.
It's really hard to comprehend what you're saying, Tim, because if you're trying to calculate what Australia's role or part is in influencing the severity of bushfires, first of all, it's by itself hard to calculate just Australia's part in that fires. And it's also the tragedy of the commons, where it's also part responsibility of nations across the world. So,
I totally agree with you, Fani. Like, yeah, we can calculate, not even necessarily with, you know, significant accuracy, the emissions, but knowing, like, how do we attribute even just like those figures, like that amount of emissions, to X amount of climate change impacts that are experienced, let alone in a localized format. And I think that that's how our brains really want to understand these things, because that's how we've been taught things make sense in. That's the formula. But that's just not reality.
Well, it doesn't that's work not how in this it, yeah. situation.
No.
Precisely. Yeah. And so I do think that that's why there is a lot of dialogue when these big disasters happen, because there's more tangibility to it.
But then does it actually affect greater change after these conversations? Because I actually think that what's happening now is quite interesting, with other countries just thinking about the political side of it, that Australia is probably more likely to do something about climate change out of a fear of being left behind by other countries and other countries investing in it and putting pressure on them politically and diplomatically, rather than in the aftermath of the bushfires. I don't know. It may be, what do you think? I mean, it was widely reported in these apocalyptic terms, but is it an effective way of communicating?
Yeah, I personally, for affecting change, I personally don't see a lot of value in using apocalyptic framing, but I think it can be helpful for people to talk through their emotions of the climate crisis.
Mm. Mm-hmm. My mum actually emailed me this ABC article, which was a hypothetical fictional future story about a young girl who grows up, I think in like 2040 or something, and it sort of tracks her life through school and as she grows up and what's normal in that period on the trajectory of, you know, climate change, sort of the medium trajectory. And it's things like, you know, at school she doesn't attend classes for half the year because of, you know, smoke or disasters or another pandemic or something, and it's quite normal, and she feels, you know, all these different feelings, and it's this whole new normal in this fictional story to give people an idea of how unborn generations may have lived experiences based on the sort of current trajectory of climate modelling. And I think what was so powerful about it is that it turns what we're using, the word we're using at the moment, it's like apocalypse or catastrophe or doomsday, but it turns it into like real experience for a person, like an individual. And I think that's where we can maybe engage constructively or like engage in a productive way with emotions and like relate to other people, even if they don't exist or even if they're not real. And when I think of the scenario in my head that actually, I suppose, like really does motivate me to kind of be interested in this topic and sort of try to do what I can to help other people is, I think this might have been back in high school, but I was sort of imagining, right, so a tsunami or a cyclone or something ripping through a village and the entire village being wiped out, and imagining a family in that village and just thinking they may lose everything that they've ever had or known. Their village may literally be like totally destroyed. They may lose people in their family. And the question for me was, how is that just if we know that human activity is exacerbating the severity and frequency and magnitude of these events? And that's sort of the hypothetical scenario that I've sort of had in my head about injustice, but it's so distant from any one person's action, it's difficult to hold, like it's difficult to allocate responsibility and accountability. And I think that's actually one of the images that sort of drives, yeah, my sort of emotion fundamentally, I think, is just even that, it's not a real thing, but it's an imagination of what could be very real and probably is some sort of lived experience from a lot of people at the moment. So I think the word imaginaries, which gets used in the Swinburne, I was practicing that Swinburne article, is also interesting because he sort of implies by using that word that it's actually not something real yet, or it's something that we're forecasting. And in the title of the article, the word spectre of climate change is used as some ethereal, ghostly thing that isn't, you know, tangible. I think that's interesting. It's a interesting choice of words. I think it's a reference to Communist Manifesto's opening words, but still, I think it's interesting that the article talks about climate change in imaginary terms, but there are also very real lived experiences happening already, I think.
Well, I think that is reflective of the way that humans generally see themselves as separate to the environment. Climate change is an environmental thing, and thus you're just witnessing it. But then also I think that title speaks to the religious undertones of this whole piece. But back to what you were saying about experience being like a grounding lens, I think that that's really powerful, and that's something that climate communication can really utilize. And how you said experience can ostracize, or not ostracize, but it can be like, well, then who has agency over this? But when we just talk about things in systems, individuals and even small or large organizations become ostracized, and this is what this article is actually saying, become ostracized from having agency over affecting change because things have been so coagulated that there's only this small group of beings that have any power over it, which ostracizes everyone from having agency to affect change, to, you know, act on climate, be it maybe not saving you from this apocalypse, but you have agency. And I think experience is a really useful lens in bringing back agency and understanding that it is all experiences sometimes, and we can all relate to that, and we can all see entry points in to affect change that's hopefully positive.
So maybe coming towards the end of the discussion, and we don't have to have answers for this necessarily, but I think one of the things that we've been skirting around a little bit is trying to figure out the way we talk about climate change in an apocalyptic way, or using apocalyptic or catastrophic language. Is that useful in some ways, or is it in many ways not useful? Like, does it, because it engenders, you know, that despair, or do you think it's useful in motivating people or organizations in some way? Or do we think that maybe one perspective might be that catastrophic descriptions about what's to come or future natural disasters or whatever is useful because it's accurate? And remembering back to our earlier discussion about our understanding of apocalyptic things or catastrophe as being very much related to being very much a subjective or an experiential thing. So maybe just to wrap up this episode, I might just go around the circle again, starting with Emily. Do you think an apocalyptic framing has its uses?
I guess what I want to highlight is it depends. So context is really important. While I think apocalyptic framings can be helpful in a context where people are not really aware of the impact of climate change, may have not sunk in yet, what the extent of the climate change impacts are and what we're facing, I think it can be helpful. But if you're already talking to a group of people that are alarmed and are very aware, you kind of can pass that point. And I think it's very important in a conversation to balance the fear aspect, like thinking about apocalyptic framing and all the emotions that come with it, whether that's fear of, like, you know, death or losing things or people. It also comes with guilt and so on and so forth. I think it's always good to pair that up with hope and focus on the things that are happening that we can do. So, yeah, it depends. And the balance is important.
Thanks, Anne. Fani, how about you? What are your final sort of thoughts on this? Do you think it's has its uses, or is it something to be avoided?
So the other day I was watching a documentary on how people in the past have predicted what the future would look like. And in terms of technological change, they were always wrong. But here we have a problem which is very much grounded in science. And maybe it cannot say exactly what is going to happen in the future, but it has a certain idea of what the impacts of climate change is. So even if you're invoking hyperbole in explaining the severity of impacts, I still think it's a useful tool to communicate the severity of the change that is happening right now.
Rosie, what are your sort of final thoughts on this?
I would agree with Emily that it depends. I'm just reflecting what you were saying before, Tim, about the imaginaries. and imagining, like, you know, the people who suffer. And even though it's true we can't measure directly who is responsible for what, I would say that is the part that gets me most caught up in, for example, like the despair side of like thinking, is just the severe injustice of it all, of who does or doesn't suffer, and how really, like, in life no one actually deserves to suffer, whether, you know, whether that's on an environmental level, but like all levels of like social justice. So I really agree with you, Zoe. Like, I'm very comfortable with just like life comes and goes, and like we will die, and then there will be other like stages and eras of like existence, you know, for this planet. So I think in terms of like the world ending, because I mean that's already also been mapped out, like how many millions of years this earth has left, that's not the bit that gets to me at all, actually. Neither is it the bit about the death. It's more about what we're doing in the meantime, and in a way I suppose the way we almost like force an apocalypse onto people, and that's the bit I think that I get depressed about. And I think that's when, I'm not sure when that is or isn't helpful, but I think if that kind of perspective helps us to think more about justice and like in general, like kindness, and, you know, as basic as that sounds, like being kind just because you should be, I think that that's when there is some benefit to the apocalyptic kind of discussion.
And Zoe, what are your sort of final thoughts? Where's your head at?
With the apocalyptic framing of things, I just think it's unnecessary. I think the science speaks for itself. Like, the science is scary enough that we don't need to embellish it or use that frame. And I think perhaps that's why I feel.
And then building on what you were saying, Rosie, because so much of my work is in disability inclusion and environmentalism, and a lot of that is moving away from victim framings. And I see apocalyptic narratives as a way of perpetuating victim framings. And when we're talking about, you know, people who are most affected, particularly by the climate crisis, you're generally talking about low socioeconomic people who have very high representation of people with disabilities. And in Australia, over half Indigenous Australians will live with a disability. And I think that putting those sort of figures in context and then bringing that sort of through with this article and this conversation, I just see apocalyptic framings as another tool to accept the injustice and to accept that it's inevitable. And that's not a frame that I choose to live in. So for me, apocalyptic framings are not useful because, you know, I'm a queer woman living with a disability, and I refuse to be victimized right now. So for me, in my context, not useful. But I hope if it brings people use and it's good in other contexts, go ahead. But there are so many more ways to conceptualize the climate crisis and to feel empowered.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Zoe, bringing it back into the context that we actually have. If we have an awareness and mindfulness about how we want to frame issues, why don't we talk about it in the context of all the other options that we have? I think that's a really good point. And Ewan, how about you? What are your sort of final thoughts on this?
On a personal level, I find apocalyptic framing to be quite disempowering, mm-hmm. and at the same time giving me a weird sense of comfort, which I spoke about earlier, in knowing that the world will continue to exist after we're gone. And I think for people that are already alarmed, then it can be very anxiety-inducing way of framing the climate debate. But I do think that it can be useful in the sense that people who are not engaged at all with the debate, it can be a way of, like, if you imagine a dystopian future, then it creates a sense of urgency and a need for action. But I think it really needs to be coupled, as Emily said, with a call to action or a sort of fear and hope being balanced a little bit, not like a purely apocalyptic framing is just incredibly disempowering. But I don't know. I think that it does have a place, but I would say it's not that effective.
Mm-hmm.
Is anyone else feeling eerily reminiscent of our media episode on conflict? And we just love the drama. So that episode we were chatting about how we love the conflict. And I remember Fani and I chatting about how we just love the drama and we connect with the conflict because there's like excitement there. In this, you know, this society where we do fetishize trauma. And so I wonder if this is perhaps another presentation of that.
It makes me think about the success of those near future apocalyptic movies and why they're so entertaining, I suppose, you know?
Yeah, because I remember going, like, I love going to the anarchist book fair and there's so many zines on, like, utopic, climate-safe futures. And, like, I live for that. It's beautiful and amazing, you know, imagining these ways, you know, that we could live in a world that looked after beings and looked up, and like when I say beings, I'm talking about the more than human experience. And, you know, as opposed to falling in love with, you know, utopias and these amazing ways of life and bringing that into the way that we conceptualize the world, how we engage with people, we just love this, you know, apocalypse. We love this dystopia. And what do we do? We've continuously manifested it. Like point to a time in history, please, to tell me where we, you know, we're not dystopic. I'm sure it might exist, but I'm sure they weren't playing with dystopias then.
Mm-hmm.
I guess maybe in a way that we kind of need a bit of both, because the way I feel, especially if we're talking about in the context of, say, like colonialism, is that as the world gets more globalized, I think sometimes we try to make our cultures more and more uniform. And so it's not about apocalyptic as in like life, death, but also like death of things. And we do in many ways obliterate cultures and way of life. We have done and we probably will keep doing. So, of course, I don't disagree with you, Zoe. Like, of course, I want to live in a world where we say, let's stop doing that. But the truth is that we do. And I think we need to sometimes sit in that and think about that so that we can progress to that idea of let's stop doing that.
Yeah, I agree, Rosie. And it's not about pretending that the issues don't exist, but it's about using our brains to spend a little bit more time imagining a better future. Because like it's just so overwhelming. It's so everywhere, and this apocalyptic framing is so overrepresented. Like, I think that understanding context and engaging in dystopic framings are two very different things. And I think that distinction is just very, very critical, because critical as in important. Sorry, I'm in thesis writing mode. I think there's power in playing in spaces where you can tease out ideas, because we'll be able to figure out what ones really don't work, what ones will be really not beneficial, particularly for the heterogeneity of experiences that live on this world. But if we continue imagining death and destruction, we will continue to do that, I think. Perhaps that's a really defiant statement. I might listen back to this and be like, you can't put this on the internet. I'm so sorry. I'm going to stop talking now.
I think there's definitely something in that, Zoe. even though it sounds quite absolute, I think there is something in that. I think for me, in terms of final thoughts, what I've learned through this discussion today is that what we mean by apocalypse or apocalyptic imaginaries of climate change is absolutely a human-centric vision, or it's a human-centric concept that we've come up with, or it's language that we use because it's experiential. But I think in many ways it depersonalizes, and therefore it sort of takes away agency, as many of you have already just mentioned. So in that sense, I think it's important to be aware of that. I don't think I have a position yet on whether I think it's a useful thing or not. It, again, I think depends on context and why you're using it and how you're using it and that sort of thing. But for me, at least, my understanding of climate change, present, past, and the way it's going, does involve significant death of people, and as Rosie was saying, even cultures and other living things and other environments and non-human worlds, and there's a lot of loss and associated grief with that sort of thing. So I think in terms of trying to grapple with reality, I think apocalypse, for me at least, is a word that I still have to describe these feelings of overwhelm or possible realities that I think are quite scary. So, yeah, definitely a lot to think about. I think it's definitely time to wrap up episode number 5. Thank you very much, everyone, for sticking with us if you've listened this far.
And
yeah, you're the best.
Sorry, I always actively cheer.
No, it's good. It's good. I'm sure there are lots of listeners cheering with you. And I think just flagging as well, one thing which might be coming up in a near episode is we thought about maybe telling our own climate stories. So keep an eye out for that if it's not published already. We'll be delving into maybe some more personal stories in a future episode. But thank you very much, everyone. Rosie, Ewan, Fani, Zoe and Emily for today's discussion. It was fascinating. I learned lots and look forward to seeing everyone in the next episode. So take care,
and
everyone.
Thank you, Tim.
Pleasure.
Also, Thanks. Can we note that whilst we might say frames have utility, we are not authorized or qualified to say whether frames are useful or not. We're just coming at it from our own perspective.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Zoe. That's a really good
point. Said in a better way, though. Someone can do that in post.
This podcast has been created and produced by Tim, Emily, Fani, Ewan, Zoe and Rosie through the ECLI Climate Communicators Program with support from the Climactic Collective. This podcast has been made for educational purposes only, and any advice and information presented is general in nature and does not consider your specific circumstances. The views, thoughts and opinions expressed by individuals do not reflect the views of ECLI or ECLI Oceania, local governments for sustainability. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rating as it helps others find us. If you're looking for more podcasts on similar topics, make sure to visit the Climactic Collective website, climactic.com.au. Thanks for listening.